Hey, you're going to love this interview with Kevin Kelly, the philosopher king of Silicon Valley. He co-founded Wired Magazine, has written multiple best-selling books, and his latest is what we talked about in this interview. Excellent advice for living, wisdom I wish I'd known earlier. I devoured the whole thing, and I pulled out a couple of my favorite little nuggets of wisdom that he included in the book. You should check it out because there's a ton of great stuff in there. We get into all of that. We talk about why it was so important for him to write this now and the impact that he hopes that it has on his children. As a fellow father, very inspirational of the why behind this book for me. And I think you're going to take a lot away from it as well. Here is Kevin Kelly. This is so your latest book, Excellent Advice for Living, Wisdom I Wish I'd Known Earlier, is not only coming out at a time that's highly appropriate for me, hopefully for the audience as well, but reminds me specifically of another one of my all-time, it's both a book and a speech. It first met me as a speech, which is Randy Pausch's last lecture. He was a professor here at CMU, and he gives this talk as he's kind of facing terminal cancer. And at the end, he kind of reveals, this is really for my kids, not for all of you, because I'm not going to be there to give them this advice as I go. And you dedicated this book to your kids. It was kind of inspired by your 68th birthday, wanting to write advice to your kids. So can you just talk a little bit about the kind of origins of wanting to pass that on to the next generation of your kin?
Yeah. I've never been a very preachy person or one liable to give sermons, and to kind of mimic one of the bits of information and wisdom in this book is to try to change your world through your behavior, not through your words, because words don't have that much effect. So we always try to model behavior for kids rather than tell them things, because growing up, we didn't pay much attention to what our parents said. It was much more what they did. So I didn't really, was not in the habit of kind of giving advice, but when I was 68, headed towards 70, I felt that there was a bunch of things that I really, really did wish I'd known earlier. This took me all my life to kind of arrive there. And the bits of advice that I did have, I would use myself. I would repeat to myself. For instance, there's one bit about if you have something you own, you know you own it, but you can't find it. And when you eventually do find it, put it back, not where you found it, but where you first looked for it. That's something I always tell myself. So I like this idea of having these little mnemonic, tweetable, transmittable things I could recall. And I decided that I should write some down for my kids. And so on my 68th birthday, in the kind of Irish tradition of giving away presents on your birthday rather than getting them, I wrote down some that I could just think off the top of my head for my son, thinking of him first. And I shared them, and they kind of, to the rest of the family and other kids and beyond, I eventually posted them, and they kind of went viral. And so that was encouraging me to do some more. So I found I had more to say when I was trying to make them this tweetable. I spent a lot of time trying to reduce them down to a few words, take a whole book of stories and whatnot, and get it down into something transmittable in a little thing. And I enjoyed that part of trying to distill them. And so I just kept going. And I found eventually every birthday sharing some more, that it had 450 of them. And I really kind of wanted to make it easy to transmit, to give it to somebody younger, wishing that I had had them when I was older.
And that's one of the lessons, you know, if you read Anti-Fragile by Nazim Taleb, he always talks about the Lindy effect, and these books that stand the test of time are probably more worthy of reading than like the latest, newest bestseller, pop science, whatever. Give it some time to see if it passes through filters before you spend the time consuming it. And really, this is, you know, despite it being a new release of a book, it's advice that has served you well over decades. And the idea of being able to have it be refined by you and your experience and say, this is the stuff that really matters. The experience is not the things, so on and so forth. And so it's just something that, you know, we all need to tap into. How did you tap into that when you were a younger man?
Well, I've collected quotes, other kind of quotes. I liked the idea of, I liked the form of a quote. And I use them. I found them as a tool. I guess maybe that's the easiest way, is that I was always attracted to them. But I guess I'd never felt I had much to say myself or teach or what, something that was new. In all honesty, some of this advice is ancient wisdom that the Stoics and the Bible might even say. I've tried to put them into my own words and kind of my own tweet, basically. And that helped me. So I think of the idea of having a heuristic was something that I liked to, when I was at Whole Earth, we like to take a whole book and extract out the few little lines that kind of represented it and gut the book. So I've always liked trying to reduce things to a little heuristic, a little principle, a little rule of thumb that you could use as a tool. And I guess I'm completing that circle by trying to do my own version of them, make these little toolish, practical heuristics that you could rely on. And I kind of have been doing that in my own head, and now I'm putting them into paper.
Well, there's 450 of them. They're very good. And I'm going to use them as a tool. A couple of my favorites as a tool to let you know the ones that I really liked, to kind of tease all the other good ones that are in there that we can't cover in a conversation so that people will go check it out. And also as a chance for you to expand on them. So this was so good. And I've never really heard anyone say it this way before, or write it this way before. So let's start off with one of my favorites. Tend to small things. More people are defeated by blisters than by mountains. I think a lot of people focus on the mountains. So can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So first of all, that is literally true. I do a lot of walking, a lot of hiking. I have these walk and talks that we do. I can talk about those. And there are some very fit people who are just basically hobbled and have to quit because of blisters. And the other rule, other advice I give it is, don't break in old shoes. Any old shoes are better than any new shoes when you're doing a long hike. So we recommend it over and over again. Don't get new shoes for this hike. Use some old shoes. And so the metaphorical idea, of course, is that, the small things pile up into the big things. Here is for the want of a nail. The army was lost. The war was lost. You may have heard that one. That was the sort of for the want of a nail, because the nail was missing. The horse shoe came off. The horse had to stop. And because the horse had to stop, the cavalry stopped. And because the cavalry stopped, the battle was lost. Because the battle was lost. So there was this idea that this one little nail, which was not on the horse, had caused the war to be lost. And that's a similar idea that you do want to not always only focus on the small things, but you just don't want to forget the small things.
And it's also just where you direct your attention, because the way my dad will talk about it sometimes is he'll say, how you do anything is how you do everything. So if you give that great attention to the application of the horseshoe to the horse's foot, and every single person of your team has that, degree of detail, everyone's going to operate in a much more effective way. And it's that kind of, standard.
It is true that you cannot give your attention equally to all things, and you should give more attention to the really big things about where you're going. This is a Peter Drucker's version of this, which is that it's not only do you have to do the right thing, but you have to make sure you have to do the thing right, do it well, but you want to make sure you're doing the right thing. Otherwise, it's kind of pointless. And so that larger view of making sure you're working on the main thing, keeping the main thing, that's worth a lot of attention. So you do have to parse your attention but you don't want to forget the small things.
And that was literally one of the other ones that I highlighted. The main thing is to keep the main thing.
Which is really hard to do. But again, I tell myself that. That's a little thing, a little mantra. You know, the main thing is to keep the main thing. And that, of course, then, you know, beckons the second question. Well, what's the main thing? And figuring out what the main thing is not easy. And I would say almost, maybe I should modify that now that I think about it, is the main thing is to figure out what the main thing is.
And then keep it the main thing.
Yeah. Well,
You know, at least I had two instances of this last year where certain things were stalled or kind of, you know, unsatisfied or not, you know, going the direction that I need them to. And sure enough, it was precisely that. There was basically a pruning that needed to occur, much in the way that you were trying to extract these, you know, essences or kind of key elements of past writings mm-hmm. into their, you know, most distilled form. The same type of thing is whether it's in life, because you accumulate things or you accumulate obligations or you accumulate, you know, projects with work that aren't really moving the ball forward. And your ability to just prune it down, prune out the 80% that actually isn't getting you towards the main thing, and the stuff that's the highest leverage, or as you said, you know, pruning the calendar or the to-do list of the things that are, you know, preventing disasters, and just keep that the main thing is exceptionally hard to do, and it probably bears repeating often.
Exactly. There was a quote, not in my book, not my piece of advice, but a quote that I heard, which is that, yes, it's true. Everything has already been said, but nobody's listening, so we need to say it again. And that's a little bit about these things. I think repeating these, being reminded of them, having it as a mantra is part of the practice.
Absolutely. And this is another one that I think everyone's heard before, but the way you connect it together stimulates something in me. The most counterintuitive truth in the universe: the more you give, the more you get. That's the part people have heard before. Understanding this is the beginning of wisdom. I'd never connected those two pieces before. So tell me more about that.
Right. So there is this sort of foundational paradox at the core of our being in the universe and how it works. This really weird thing that is the beginning of understanding how things work and how reality, which is that you give away, that it's sharing and ultimately a giving out in order to get anything or to grow or everything else comes from this counterintuitive, this sort of unbelievable, weird, nonsensical gifting out. And yet we know that you can count on it. It's so reliable. It's a business strategy these days, you know, giving away things for free, starting. But it's also a foundational aspect of us, which is the default of humans, is altruism and collaboration. And it's not selfishness. Sure, selfishness occurs, but that is actually not the default position. And that everything we have in civilization actually is built on the same altruism and collaboration. And that I think later on I make a little bit of advice, which is that if you take on the default that humans are good and trustworthy, there will be times when you are cheated, but that's a small tax to pay for the huge benefits you get from people treating you the best. So you're going to get the best of people when you trust them. And that outweighs whatever little cheating you get done, no matter what it is. And so pay the price.
And trust one people. One of my mantras for the last half year or so has been invert, always invert. So yes, it's a small price to pay for all the good that comes from that kind of more open, right. altruistic perspective. But you know, you never think of, okay, you're open, you're trusting, you kind of pay that little price. What is that compared to the alternative of being cloistered and closed up and always on guard and what's missed out from that. It's so hard to draw that parallel, but that is the calculation that is actually relevant.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you there's a negative. You're deducted. You're subtracted when you're closed.
Yeah.
You can't partake in this sort of exfoliation, this exuberance of people trusting each other and doing their best and giving their best, and you don't get to participate if you are always suspicious and don't trust people.
Changing speeds or lanes a little bit, another one that just jumped out to me, and I think there's a degree to which the ones that are jumping out to me are, you know, advice that my dad's given me, but just kind of in a different wrapper. So predisposed to have a jump out. Because before you are old, attend as many funerals as you can bear. Nobody talks about the departed's achievements. The only thing anyone will remember is what type of person you were as you were achieving.
Yeah. I mean, that is just literally, that's what it was. I have, you know, I've seen a lot more funerals these days because of my age. And I was struck. This is literally an observation that I was there. I was struck that people were not talking about their 25 patents or, you know, the award that they won. It was who they were, what they were like. They made them laugh. They were kind. They were, you know, whatever. So it was like, oh my gosh, this is important. And I listened to, when I was growing up, there was a guy on the radio, Gene Shepherd, who every night for 45 minutes told stories that he made up. He later on wrote a couple of shows. One was The Christmas Story about the Red Ryder rifle. But he used to say something every now and then that was just like, oh my gosh. He said, look, it's a certainty that in 5,000 years, nobody will have any memory of you whatsoever. You'll be completely gone. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's a hard truth to accept, is that we'll be forgotten completely. But so your achievements are just, no matter what your achievements are, the best we can do is kind of to be remembered for who we were and what we were like in the immediate time, because our achievements, there's very few people whose achievements will be remembered in 5,000 years.
Yeah. And another part of that, once again, bring it back to my dad, is he says, you know, always go to the funeral. And particularly for the stage that I'm in, it's rarely, you know, occasionally it is the folks you're really close with, but it's more often a second layer where it's someone's parent, someone's grandparent, you know, these kind of tangential relationships. And the other part of it that he always says is, yes, very important to internalize what you articulated there, Kevin, but also you will remember everyone that's at your parents' funeral, that's at your sibling's funeral, those people that are closest to you. And a lot of people, like even you acknowledge it there, as many funerals as you can bear, because we are busy. It is hard. It's not going to the amusement park or something.
Right, right, right.
But the fact that you made the effort to be there in that person's time of crisis and the forging of friendships and connections that comes from that is really
powerful. Right. Funerals were not for the departed. They're for the living.
Yeah.
There's actually, the galley you have is just the galley. There was a couple of, there were some additional pages added. And so there's a bit of advice that's not in the version that you saw, which is kind of a evolution of my own thinking on this, which is that, it's something I'm trying to do now, which is to not wait till the funeral to give the eulogy for the person, to do it in writing while they're still living and can enjoy it. Because that's something else I've been kind of struck. It's like, why didn't we say these things?
Yeah,
when that person was alive, they don't get to hear this tribute, and they should be honest. And so, so I'm trying to do that, is to not wait for the eulogy to share something about a person, because it means, and when I get a letter of that nature, it's just very powerful, very, very powerful. So why not share that while they're still living?
That's a beautiful sentiment. That sounds like a potential challenge for later in the episode. We'll see if we
there you go.
So you reference, you know, some of the advice in here is timeless. It's from, it's recycled, whether, you know, the Bible or these other practices. And one of the things you said basically sounds like tithing to me. When you give away 10% of your income, you lose 10% of your purchasing power, which is minor compared to the 110% increase in happiness.
It's you know, not everybody can, this is tough for many people who are struggling with just trying to make ends meet, but I know that one of the things we've tried to instill with our kids is giving, sharing, philanthropy, even when you don't have very much money, right? Because that's the time to start. It's actually when you don't have a lot. And 10%, the joy that you get, 10% is like, well, you might notice it. If you're on the edge, you will notice it. But for most people who have gone beyond the edge, 10% is something you can do. It's a doable amount, but the satisfaction and the joy that you get from it is really hard to believe until you've done it. And it goes back to that kind of thing you said before about this counterintuitive principle that you actually will get more back when you give away that 10% than you've given. And until you do it, it's kind of hard to believe that it works, but it does work.
Yeah. And I mean, if you could buy an increase in happiness with just a little bit of money, it's usually what we're in pursuit of with all that spending anyways, or at least.
Exactly. You're right. Instead of the 10% going to a boat, believe me, you don't want a boat. Give it away in a creative way, and you'll be much, much happier.
Speaking of creativity, one of your ones is on brainstorming, improvising, jamming with others. Mm-hmm. You'll go much further and deeper if you build upon each contribution with a playful yes and example instead of a deflating no but reply.
Right. That's one of the first principles of improv. If you've taken any class on improv, that's the first thing they teach you. That's how you keep the game going, is that you don't say, you know, someone has some crazy idea. You don't say no, but no, you say yes, and you build on each other's. And there comes a moment when you're trying to make something that you have to begin to take away and say no to things. But in that creative beginning, the genesis, you want to be yes and, yes and. And I have been in many meetings where you're trying to make something creative. And believe me, the person in the corner who's objecting to everything, they're not invited back. The person who's like, yes and, let's do this, and let's do yes and, the same thing. And also, by the way, I do a lot of travel with people and strangers. And the person say, let's, you want to go down and see what this at the festival is. If they say no, I'm tired, they're not coming back. But if they say yes, so I've traveled with yes people. I travel with people who say yes to everything when you're traveling. Oh my gosh, that's what you want to be in. You want to be in the yes and mode for that creative energy of learning and experiencing instead of no, but. So it's a really good heuristic for when you're trying to create something and working with a team.
And it's tied to the trust thing too, because you don't want to be yes and whenever like the spam caller, you know, tries to yes and my social security number is blah, 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 like not in that environment, but it's the pre, you know, the precursor of degree of trust or relationship that, you know, creates all the space for that.
Right. And some of my advice is the opposite there, is to be totally skeptical of scammers and just to cut to the chase, the short answer is you want to be in control of the channel. So if they're calling you, you tell them nothing, you cooperate nothing. Anything you need for your account, you have to initiate. That's basically the rule of thumb.
Got it. Well, I've got one more here that I want to explore as, you know, a much younger father than you, but One of your advices is don't be the best, be the only.
Mm.
And, you know, I to some degree, it's never too late to change that. But I think particularly as a father, cultivating that, protecting that, nurturing that in kids,
yeah,
to help them avoid, you know, conformity and that kind of
thing
that we have to do.
The thing about that's don't be the best. Don't aim to be the best. Aim to be the only. That will take all your life, is what I'm going to say. This is a lifelong project because it is the highest bar. And it's very, 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 very difficult to understand what it is that you're the only about, that you only you can do. It's taken me, and I'm still working on it, 70 years to figure out. And there are occasional some child prodigy who will immediately have a sense of what they can do that nobody else can do. But most of us, it takes all our lives working at this. And it's not a matter necessarily of just being unconventional or alternative. It actually requires tremendous help from outside. This is why we have families, why we have communities, why we have neighbors and friends and colleagues, is to help us figure out what we're the best and only about, because we can't do it by ourselves. It's something you really cannot do on your own, is to arrive at this idea of what it is that I can do that nobody else can do. And so that's a long process, and with your own kids, you'll be one of several different forces helping them see that. It's a sort of a business of trying lots of things. It's a business of trying to cultivate self-awareness so that you have some idea of you can listen to feedback. It's an idea of striving, inhibition. There's lots of things that go in it. But anyway, yes, it's good to start when they're kids, but I think you should not expect to see results too much further on down the line. And it is the goal that we can arrive at our, you know, the day before dying and say, yes, I have fully become myself. I am the one and only. That is what we're aiming for, but I think it takes most of our life to get there.
Well, it seems almost like by definition, it's up to them to be the only. You can't have someone do that on your behalf. But it you know, the ability to, you know, at least the stories you hear, like the Collison brothers, like any obscure book they wanted, their parents would just go get for them or find a way to help them, you know, get that orthogonal piece of literature or whatever the thing was that was part of where their curiosity was leading them.
Right, right. That's the business of kind of like they're a blank slate a little bit in the sense of us knowing what it is or them knowing what it is. And you kind of want to you want to maximize exploration to see if they have musical talents, to see if they have athletic talents, to see if they have intellectual talents. And so you don't know. And so that is the business when they're young, is really to kind of keep exposing to them and feeding whatever native ambition or appetite they have for things as one way to do it. In our own experience, the kids can be very interested in one thing when they're young and turn, almost like they kind of satisfied that and turn later on. So, it's a ongoing journey for their life. So it's a lifelong project, let me put it that way.
Well, as we aim towards wrapping up here, Kevin, I want to ask about the connection between imagination and optimism, because you've also written a bit about just, you know, being optimistic, futures defined by the optimists.
Yeah.
And it requires imagination to really be able to execute on that. And if you find yourself being negative, it's almost like a, you know, people, I always love, like, when people say something and they don't realize that they're saying the other thing. It's like, if they say they're not optimistic, it kind of is a tell that they don't have a ton of imagination. So tell me more about that.
Well, one of the things I say in the book of advice is that imagination is one of the things you can improve. And it is the genesis. It's the beginning of almost any great thing is someone imagining it first. And it is something where really one of the few things in life where you can ignore, in a certain sense, what other people have done. Most of the time you can't, for to do science and history and other lots, most of Earth and the work that we need to do, we rely on what's come before us. But when you're imaginative, there is a degree in which you are unleashed from what has come before. And I find that it's actually, and people who teach it, trying to become imaginative, find that it's the thing, the hardest thing, actually is, from what we know, and in kind of in a curious way, some of the people who are most knowledgeable have the most difficulty being imaginative. And we did this thing with Wired where we had the experts kind of predict advances in their own field. And by and large, they were wrong. It was outside people who were better at predicting new things because the experts knew too much. They knew how difficult they were. They had them way far away because they thought they were going to be really, really hard because they knew so much. And so knowing, having some idea about the future is actually one of the hardest things to overcome if you actually want to get better at trying to imagine what it will be. And so we found that it's really hard to kind of really become imaginative because you kind of have to believe the impossible in some ways. You have to go out of what is known and what you know and what people expect. And that is actually hard for people who know a lot. It's actually hard for some of the smartest people. And that's why practicing your imagination, exercising your imagination in other forms is really great, even for what it is that you're doing. And I think it's a skill that's not trained enough. It's not cultivated enough.
How do you practice it?
By very, very deliberately. So I'll do exercises. We have these things called scenario workshops and others. And there's a couple little tricks. It's like anything else. There's a skill, there's a craft, there's some tricks. One of the tricks is to is to assume that the official version of things is completely wrong. Okay? So, as a little exercise, okay, I assume, I'm 100% sure that AI is going to be the big thing. But let's assume, for the moment, that I'm totally wrong, and the AI is just a little fad, it'll go away. So we say, well, how would that happen? What could possibly be responsible for that? How would that play out? So you do the counterfactual. You imagine and play with the counterfactual to kind of force you to take a different route. So that idea of like confronting the impossible, what Brian Eno and I called the unthinkables. What are the unthinkables? And you take the unthinkables and you kind of say, well, what if they were true? So there are tricks like that, like trying to, the other thing that some people do, I think I was convinced that Marvin Minsky did this almost by habit. He would look at the world as if he was not a human, as if he was a robot. So like he would say, like, music, what's this music thing? Why are humans... Why do they cry when I listen to music? That's so weird. I don't get that because he can't hear. He's a robot. He can't hear music. So he's sort of exploring. So like what? So your view, it's a self-distancing. You're outside you're a Martian or you're a robot and you're coming to view things. And so you have no preconceptions. So that actually helps with the imaginative work of, again, letting go of what we expect to help us see beyond. So there are kind of trade craft in that sense.
Interesting. Because I've always...
There's one of the things we're seeing right now, and this is a larger topic, with this AI, artificial intelligence, generative AI, which is generating new things. And I say they have artificial creativity, but it's lowercase creativity. It's creativity of the kind of sense of what a logo designer would be doing. They're designing a logo for a company and they want it to be creative, and it's a small C creativity. It's a little bit better, you know, so something new, but not a breakthrough. For the breakthrough creativity, the capital C creativity, you know, the understanding DNA, seeing what DNA was like, or relativity, or some of these breakthrough capital C creativity, that's usually not a matter of more information. That's just being able to see from completely different view. That's a work of imagination. That's not because there was any additional information there. It was just a different view. And that's much harder for AI to do now. I think the we can be assisted in the lowercase creativity, which is needed and good. Designing another book cover for a book. But if you wanted to invent something that was not a book at all, or not a cover, then that's where imagination kind of comes in.
Got it. Well, you have not only designed but written a heck of a book here, Kevin. You've written many great books, but I really enjoyed this one, and it got my wheels spinning. There are many, many, many more. Yep, there it is for those watching on the video. Excellent Advice for Living, and a lot of, you know, good timeless stuff in there that can help people. And I love the challenge of pass it on to someone younger if you benefited from it. Yes. So I will be trying to do that. I hope that folks will grab the book and do that as well. You can find it on Amazon, but what other links do you want to direct people to learn more?
Yeah, so I have a website homepage with my initials, kk.org, where I kind of try to keep current. So the one other way to kind of keep current is we've had a newsletter for 6 years now, every week on Sunday morning, Recommendo. Three of us, me and Mark and Claudia, we make two recommendations each. Very little, a little paragraph, a little sentence, tweetable kind of thing, of something that we recommend. Something to read, watch, follow, go places, something useful, tool, whatever. And that's a good way to kind of keep up. That's Recommendo with one M. But also, you can find that on kk.org.
Beautiful. We're going to link it all in the show notes in the app. We're probably listening to this right now, or at goingdeepwithaaron.com/podcast for every single episode of the show. My URL is a little bit longer than Kevin's. He got the two letters there, but we're trying our best. Kevin, this has been fantastic. Like I said, I really enjoyed it. And I just enjoyed talking to you and seeing whatever pathways we go down in terms of different ideas. I'd love to wrap this up with a challenge for the audience. Give you the mic one final time to set us off with something to do.
I'm the co-chair of the Loan Now Foundation. We try to cultivate long-term responsibility and imagination, trying to think for long-term, take a long-term perspective. In short, what we're trying to do is to be a good ancestor. And the challenge I would have is to think about how you could be a good ancestor, what you could do. A very simple thing is you can plant a tree. As you know, the old saying that the best time to plant a tree was 25 years ago. Second best time is today. So think about what your great-grandchildren might want from here, from the world, or from you, and kind of work, do one little thing that future generations might thank you for in a curious way. Or, and by the way, you might want to thank your great grandparents themselves for something that they've done that you're kind of benefiting from today. And most of, as I look around, most of what I am seeing was done by somebody else, not me, from the roads to the buildings, to this structure, to the plumbing. It was all done by somebody else, and they have, I'm thank you for this civilization around us. So anyway, so think about how you might be a good ancestor.
That is a beautiful note to wrap up on, Kevin. And I am grateful for the challenge, grateful for you sharing your time with us, and grateful for the new book. I hope you have a lovely day.
Well, thank you so much. It's my pleasure. Thanks for the great questions.
We just went deep with Kevin Kelly. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day. Hey, thanks for listening to the end of my interview with Kevin Kelly. If you enjoyed it, I think you'd also enjoy my past interview with Jason Wolf, the serial entrepreneur behind giftcards.com and dozens of other businesses. He talks about how he's thoughtfully structured his companies and the lessons he's learned along the way to multiple 8- and 9-figure exits. I took a lot away from that interview. I know that you will as well. Go check it out.